plenty of golf happening all around the world, including on the DP World Tour in Ireland. This is Jorge Campillo, his second shot at the par 5 fifth, the former standout at the University of Indiana, making a run on this Friday. He would two-putt from that point for birdie to get to 12 under and a one-shot lead. PGA Tour, John Deere Classic, Charles Howell III, the veteran, been around for 20-plus years, his second at the par 5 second. That would lead to a two-putt birdie as well. You could see the clouds lingering. There was a weather delay shortly after. Good news, they're back out on the golf course, and golf today underway on a Friday. We take a look at the leaderboard. JT Poston still the man at the top after the 9-under 62. We'll talk Poston and a whole lot more as golf today underway on this Friday.
Golf Today, brought to you by PointsBet.
Greetings and welcome into Golf Today. Steve Burkowski alongside Eamon Lynch. We're with you for a couple hours leading into the John Deere Classic. Plenty to talk about, Eamon, but we have some news coming out of the world on the DP World Tour this morning. DP World Tour CEO Keith Pelley released a statement responding to the players who have joined LIV Golf, and this comes after a letter that some of the LIV Golf players wrote to the DP World Tour threatening legal action, which was leaked to the media. The ongoing saga continues. We talked about it yesterday. We will continue to touch on it today. But before we get to some of the scathing words of Keith Pelley, here's a brief review of what transpired over the last couple of weeks. Last week, the DP World Tour announced sanctions to its members who teed it up in the LIV Golf Series first event at the Centurion Club earlier in June. Those sanctions included a £100,000 fine, which equates to roughly $120,000, as well as a suspension from playing in the Genesis Scottish Open, the Barbasol Championship, and Barracuda Championship, all three events co-sanctioned with the PGA Tour. Then earlier this week, as reported by several media outlets, 16 LIV Golf players, including Lee Westwood and Ian Poulter, sent a letter to the DP World Tour asking it to remove the sanctions and allow them to compete in the Scottish Open next week. The players gave the tour until today to take away the sanctions or else possible legal action was in its future. Well, today, DP World Tour CEO Keith Pelley responded to this letter, and he did not hold back, saying in part, before joining LIV Golf, players knew there would be consequences if they chose money over competition. Many of them at the time understood and accepted that. Indeed, as one player named in the letter said in a media interview earlier this year, if they ban me, they ban me. It is not credible that some are now surprised with the actions we have taken. Pelley was far from done. The letter claims that these players care deeply for the DP World Tour. An analysis of the past participation statistics on our tour in recent years of the several leading players' names suggests otherwise. One player in particular named in the note has only played in 6 Rolex Series events in the past 5 years, and another one just 4 of those Rolex Series events. Furthermore, given how deeply these players say they care about the DP World Tour, perhaps some of them could have played in Ireland this week in support of our new title sponsor, in particular, one player who gave us a signed commitment to play at Mount Juliet. Finally, it would not be appropriate for me to comment on any potential legal matters. I will simply reiterate that our members' regulations, which have been enforced for more than 30 years, have been accepted by all players, and they're there to protect all of our members, and we will use them to take all the necessary steps to protect their interests. Again, those were the comments by Keith Pelley, and the sanctions for those members who knowingly broke our rules by playing at the Centurion Club without a release are proportionate, fair, and I believe considered necessary. The majority of the members, a lot to really unfold. We'll get into it over the course of the next couple of hours. And with that, we say hello to Rex Hoggard. He is in Ireland for us for the Horizon Irish Open. And Rex, you have been following this story since the very beginning. What's your reaction to the statement from Keith Pelley?
Steve, shortly after this story broke, Patrick Harrington was finishing up his round, and he provided context, as he normally does, and he normally does it very, very well. He pointed out first and foremost, as you just read in that memo, these players knew what was coming. He was a little surprised that those 16 players didn't feel like that they were blindsided by this. He pointed out that the DP World Tour has been very clear on this, that any of their players who violate their tournament regulations and play in a LIV Golf event, there would be consequences, and now we have seen those consequences. He also pointed out that he's talked with a lot of European Tour members this week. And he said the vast majority of those members support what the tour is doing as far as punishment for those players. He said, in fact, many of those players feel like they didn't go far enough with those punishments. And I also want to point out, you just read that statement from Keith Pelley, and he's clearly emotional in that statement. Well, there was another communique that he sent out this morning that just went to the membership, and he was even more emotional in that communication. He pointed out, first and foremost, he apologized for sending any kind of statement at all out during a tournament round day. He said he never wants to do that, but because of what he called inaccuracies in that letter from those 16 players, he felt like, quote, he could remain silent no longer. Steve?
Rex, appreciate that. We'll be in touch with you a little bit later on in the show. Passionate, emotional, some words that Rex used to describe the statement from Keith Pelley. What would you use to characterize what he said today?
I thought it was a pretty eloquent and strident way to tell these guys to pound sand, which is exactly what Keith Pelley ought to be telling them to do. I mean, a choice was made here, and they had that choice on which tour they wanted to play. And, you know, their letter, it read like the drunken email of some aging playboy who ran away to have an affair and then is now angry that his wife won't let him come and go as he pleases between her and his mistress. I mean, it's asinine in some respects. And the fact that they set a 5 p.m. deadline for the European Tour to rescind their sanctions was, you know, an implied threat that legal action will follow. As of now, legal action has not yet followed. It probably will. I would be more surprised, frankly, if it didn't at this point, because this is just another stage in an endgame. We're getting to the sort of bluster phase of the proceedings at this stage, but clearly there's litigation that's going to follow at some point.
What do you think the endgame is for today, at least, the players from the DP World Tour? As you said, maybe the veiled threat of litigation of what do they want to get out of it when all we hear seemingly is we want to play less and control our schedule, and yet they still want to have their cake and eat it too. Why?
World ranking points is really what it comes down to here. These guys face the prospect that the LIV Golf Series is not imminently going to get world ranking points. Who knows what happens down the road when they have filed the application and it's considered by the board of the world rankings, but that's not imminent. So these guys are facing playing for quite a period of time now with no world ranking points. That's the criteria by which most of them are likely to qualify for major championships. And you're right about this idea of, you know, we want to spend more time with our family. It's an obvious lie, and it's exposed as a lie all the time, because the minimum amount of tournaments a player would have to play on the PGA Tour to maintain voting rights is 15, and that includes four major championships. It includes a President's Cup, includes a Ryder Cup if they play there. The number is actually even less on the DP World Tour, whereas the LIV Golf Series has announced as of last night they plan to have 14 events next year. So you add in four majors that these guys think they can play then as well, they would actually be playing more under this system. And it really does come down to this idea of using the existing tours, the PGA Tour, the DP World Tour, for world ranking points. They want to take the money from the Saudi Tour and be parasites on the tours that they've abandoned. And Keith Pelley's telling them you're not going to do that.
On the flip side, how do you think this statement for DP World Tour members resonate, hearing the words of Keith Pelley, knowing they're committed to this tour and maybe the alliance with the PGA Tour? What do they take from it, knowing that he was out there and he said, you know what, guys, no more?
I talked to a couple of people this morning who were at the Irish Open, and I talked to a bunch of guys last week on site up in Hartford at the Travelers, and you shouldn't underestimate the amount of resentment that is now bubbling forth in the locker rooms on either of those tours, because they realise that these guys want to be barnacles on their tour and still suck the blood out of them and then continue while taking their cash payment from the LIV Golf Series. And they're fine. If you want to leave, take the money, go. But the idea that you can come back and avail yourselves of what everyone else on this tour is working for, that resentment is really seems to be growing on both tours right now. So even if an injunction was filed, which I expect it would be, against the DP World Tour and its sanctions, even if the DP World Tour were to lose that injunction and these guys do show up next week at the Renaissance Club for the Scottish Open, that's not necessarily a loss for the DP World Tour, because the reception those guys could probably expect in the locker room would be pretty hostile, I would think.
You talk about the resentment. We shared the words from Freddie Couples yesterday, his thoughts on Phil Mickelson, Pat Perez, and others. As we said, the saga continues. It is far from over. The second LIV Golf Series event began yesterday at Pumpkin Ridge Golf Club in Portland, Oregon, and it marked the first LIV event held in the United States. And in an expected move, a memo was sent out to the PGA Tour players announcing more suspensions following yesterday's shotgun start. Those players including Bryson DeChambeau, Brooks Koepka, Patrick Reed, Matthew Wolff, Carlos Ortiz, Abraham Ancer, and Pat Perez. These players joined 17 others who were suspended after teeing it up in the first LIV golf event at the Centurion Club last month. We're just getting things going on golf today. When we return, we'll take you out to Silvis, Illinois, the home of the John Deere Classic. Get you caught up on round two play. That and a whole lot more comes your way right after this.
Golf Today, brought to you by PointsBet. This season, don't just bet, live your bet life.
We're back on golf today. Ever since 2000, the John Deere Classic has called TPC Deer Run home. And for two decades, we've seen birdies, eagles galore, a 59, and some stars kickstart their careers right here on this course. And this week, we hope it's no different. Let's catch up on some highlights from round number two from the Quad Cities. Patrick Rogers at the third, the par three. Not a bad way to kick this one off.
Oh, I hope he doesn't have to buy drinks in the clubhouse after this one, Steve.
Let's see. He's got a chance. Getting better. Oh, yes. He did it. Hole in one, Patrick Rogers. Diet Cokes all around for the crew when their day is through. We're setting the bar high. How about Sahith Theegawa at the par 4, 11th, third from just off the green.
Went on the save par. Stayed two over.
Yeah, we wondered how he would bounce back after the heartbreak at 18 at the Travelers a few days ago. Speaking of the 18th, the par 4 here at Deer Run, coming off a bogey at the par 5, 17th. Got to start getting something going if he wants to be around for the weekend.
This from 101 yards. Gets it inside of 15 feet. Made birdie. Got back to two over.
Yeah, still work to do for Theegawa. How about the defending champion, Lucas Glover, par 4, 15th. This for birdie.
From 15 feet for the former U.S. Open champion.
All right, Lucas rolls that one in. Started on the backside, now on the front, the par 3 third. 37-footer for birdie. Maybe. Yeah. Oh, yes.
Get a little fist bump from Zach Johnson.
Try to get a little mojo going. Glover to one under. How about Tommy Two Gloves Gainey, par 4 8th. This for birdie.
24 feet, trying to get the six under.
Oh, look at him walk that one in. Tommy Gainey throwing his name into the mix on a Friday at the John Deere, and he wasn't done. This for another birdie at 16.
This one from 15 feet, Steve. Same result.
Might this be the week for Gainey to get back in the winner's circle on the PGA Tour? David Lipsky over at 14. Eamon, we've got a trend here. Putts are going in from everywhere.
So it's no surprise that this one goes to Lipsky to 5 under.
28-footer gets him to 5, as you said, then at the par 5 second. Okay, how about a quality long iron from 222 yards?
The man looking for a little bit of form. He had three top 10s in March, April, but he's been quiet either side of that this season.
Back of the green, two putts for his birdie from there, moving him to 8 under par. Now Michael Gligic, his turn at 16. We saw Patrick Rogers make a hole-in-one on 3. Could we get another? Maybe? Possibly?
Maybe the bartender is going to work overtime today?
Thought about it. Make the short one, get him to 8 under par. Charles Howell III, his turn at 16. Just inside of 20 feet for birdie.
Closing in on the lead here, gets himself to 5 under par.
Charles Howell III in search of his fourth career PGA Tour victory. Started on the back nine, over on the first, his 10th. Not necessarily the ideal spot to play your second shot.
from 107 yards in the fairway bunker, but he gets that to 4 feet. And with birdie, yeah, he gets a 6-under.
Charles Howell the third making a bit of a move then here at the second. How about this? We saw it at the top of the show. Worth another look. Always been a wonderful ball striker. That's never been the issue for Charles Howell the third.
Knocks that one up to 15 feet.
And two putts for birdie, get to 8-under as well. So not a ton of separation from those out this morning for their second round. JT posting that mark of 9-under, 62 from yesterday. Still holding on. How about Christopher Goddard? We talked about him yesterday. In on a sponsor's exemption. Just one shot back as round two continues to roll along from the Quad Cities. And at this moment, we say hello to Kira K. Dixon, who is out on the grounds at the John Deere Classic. And Kira, there were some weather issues this morning coming through Silvis. The good news, they're back out on the golf course. What's the very latest?
They are back out on the golf course, Berko, but the horn did blow at 10:31 a.m. local time. I spoke with on-site meteorologist Kyle Koval, and they said that they decided to blow the horn because there was just too much lightning getting a little bit close to the grounds here at TPC Deer Run. During that about hour and 15-minute delay, we did get a bit of rain here on property, and then play resumed at 11:45 a.m. local. Now, we should be okay for the rest of the day, light. Lightning-wise, should be mostly cloudy for the rest of the day. Maybe a few showers here and there, those pesky showers till about 3 p.m., but nothing that should threaten play and force us to have another weather delay. Now, someone that is going to be waiting just about an hour for his tee time this afternoon is our leader after round one, JT Poston. Now, last week at the Travelers, he opened in round one with a 62. So, Berko, what do you do in your following week on the PGA Tour? Will you do it again? A nice little 62 in his first round here at the John Deere Classic. This is what he said that led him to that score after round one.
I'm just excited about where my game is. And, you know, when your game's in a place like that and confidence is high, you just want to get on the golf course as fast as possible. And it was nice to get out there and get off to a great start this week and shoot a low one.
What were the lessons learned last week that you were able to see immediately pay off in the round today?
You know, just trying to stay patient. I think, you know, it's easy to say that when you shoot 9-under, but you know the scores can be low out here, and so it's easy to make some pars early maybe, and you want to start forcing it. And I just told myself, I keep hitting a lot of greens, I'm putting it well, I'm hitting it good, I'm going to give myself plenty of looks and make some birdies. So just trying to stay patient, not only today, but the rest of the week.
Speaking of birdies, you had that nice last walk-off birdie with the putt, the 26-footer. Just talk us through what you were feeling standing over that putt and then what it was like walking away from that green with a birdie.
Yeah, I mean, 9's a bonus. It's playing pretty tough today. If you'd have told me on the tee I could make 4 and get out of there, I'd have taken it in a heartbeat. But I hit 2 great shots in there to 20, 25 feet, and I got a pretty good read on the speed from Chad's putt, so I felt good about the speed of the putt, and it really didn't have a ton of break on it, so I knew if I just, you know, got it started online, and it would go right in there. So it was nice to end that way.
Now, I know we mentioned putting at the end there, but he said yesterday the thing that really helped him to have the day that he had was his iron play. He ranked 12th in strokes gained approach yesterday, and he said he's been putting a lot of work into his ball striking, and he's seeing results coming out of that hard work, which is giving him plenty of confidence to be more aggressive in his iron play, guys.
Yeah, it certainly worked on day one. Kira, stay dry, keep the weather away, enjoy the rest of round two in the Quad Cities. Take a look at some of those highlights from JT Poston and that 62 on Thursday, Eamon, and it was really one of those complete rounds as we take a look at his second and 14.
This was a little pitch up from 46 yards, nestles it up to 4 feet. That was a birdie. That got him to 2-under.
Yeah, and he was far from done. He started on the back nine, so on the front side, his second nine, par five, second eagle putt, 26 feet and change. Yes, he does. That would move him to 7-under par. And then if you're going to miss greens and shoot 62, you need things like this to happen at the fourth.
Rolls this one in. Gets to 8, under par.
You get a sense it's your day when you're pulling it out from the bunker, rolling in 20, 30 footers or another 26 footer and change at the ninth. his final hole of the day, part of a 9-under 62. Kira alluded to it. He opened with 62 yesterday, and since 1983, JT Poston is the only player in PGA Tour history in back-to-back weeks to have first rounds of 62 or better.
That's when you know you are rolling your balls.
Yeah. Let's see if he can continue that on Friday, 2:54 Eastern. That tee time delayed. It'll go off about an hour and 25 minutes from now alongside Chad Ramey and Ryan Brem at the John Deere Classic.
Well, this is what we call a beautiful, soft summer day in Ireland, but it made things harder for players at the Horizon Irish Open. We'll bring you up to speed on all the highlights from Mount Juliet Estate right after the break.
This week, the DP World Tour pays a visit to Mount Juliet Estate for the Horizon Irish Open. Three players will punch their ticket to the 150th Open at St. Andrews on Sunday. Let's take a look at some of the highlights from round number two and start with Padraig Harrington at the par 5 17th, his third just off the green.
2007 Irish Open champion, a hometown favorite.
Coming off the U.S. Senior Open Championship as well a few days ago. He made birdie shot 71 in a 3-under. How about Shane Lowry? This for birdie at 12.
And at this point, Lowry is three strokes outside the cut line.
That would get him back to even par. Still work to do. See if he could roll in another one here at 16.
When you see the layers coming off, you know it's getting a little bit better weather-wise.
That would move Shane Lowry to 1-under par. How about another at 18? Look at the fans out there, Eamon.
He's a popular man. He's the Irish guy from Central Casting, Shane Lowry.
Finishes with four straight birdies, shoots 70, 2-under par. How about Seamus Power at the par 5 fifth? Birdie putt, about 25 feet or so.
He's leading the pack of the Irish guys. He was 4-under starting the day. This gets him back to 4-under.
He is really coming to his own over the last 12 to 18 months. Then at the par 4 7th. Another look at birdie to move to 5-under par. The umbrella's back out, so the indifference of the Irish weather front and center. No impact whatsoever on Power. Then at the par 3 11th, again a theme recurring here, with 15 and 20 footers dropping like nobody's business. How about that?
Got him to 8-under par for the championship.
Yeah, back-to-back rounds of 68 for Seamus Power. Some others playing well, like Adrian Marung, the par 4 first. This for birdie.
13 feet, he gets to 9-under par.
And he wasn't done. Marung now at the par 4 ninth. Second shot, how close could he get it?
Going to get it a lot closer than you or I would, Steve.
Oh, no doubt about it. We'll call it about a foot and change. He would make that for birdie. Second straight round of 5-under 67. He is in at 10-under par. How about Jorge Campillo, former standout at Indiana during his college golf days in the States, but what a second shot at the par 5 fifth.
From 237 yards, gets it to 4 feet.
But he would miss that one for eagle. Make it for birdie, shoots 68. In at 11-under par and currently a one-shot lead over a couple of players giving chase, but Power, Lowry, Harrington appear to have a tee time secure heading into Saturday's third round. And with that, we say hello once again to Rex Hoggard. And Rex, a very good-looking leaderboard in Ireland. What are some of your takeaways from Friday there at the Irish Open?
Steve, as you just pointed out, Jorge shot a 68. He's 11-under par in the lead. Now, there's two players at 10-under par right behind him. The only three things those players have in, the only thing those players have in common is that they all played early before the weather came in and turned ugly and turned this Irish Open into a vastly different test.
Well, overall, just my game was quite solid. Off the tee was way better than yesterday and held a few nice putts. My wedges were strong, so yeah, quite happy with my game overall.
You look at your game the last few weeks. I think you have four top tens in your last six starts on the European Tour. What seems to have clicked so far for you this season?
Well, I've been working, you know, my off season on my wedges and short game, and that improved a lot from last year. So I think that was the main key. But as I said, I'm pretty happy with my game overall. I found like a good balance across the whole game. So I'm trying to repeat that every week, and it seems to be working so far.
It was a tough ending. I think I take advantage of the beginning. The weather was a little better, but then when we get to number 10, start to get a little the wind pick up and then start the rain, so it was a tough finish.
What part of your game was working so well the last 2 days?
I think pretty much everything was working good. So yes, I think I feel I'm in a good position. I am confident with my swing and I putt good these 2 days. So hopefully I keep putting like that.
I don't mind playing on the wind or tough days or cold. I don't mind that, but on the rain is not my favorite. But I have some good runs in the rain as well. So I guess you just gotta be patient and think that it can be rainy in Ireland, of course. So I just gotta be ready for that.
If you look at the scores, it seems like it's going to be a birdie fest going the rest of the way. Are you comfortable having to go low?
Not necessarily, but it is what it is. And if it's windy, it can play a little harder. But if not, I guess I will have to make birdies.
The good news for the remaining field is it does look like there's going to be a reprieve on the weekend. The rain chances actually fall to 70% on Saturday, and then by the time we get to Sunday, it's only a 15% chance and plenty of sunshine. So, Eamon, it looks like you are not going to get that forecast you were hoping for. Steve?
Rex, we appreciate it. I can appreciate Rex in a three-layer day out there. It gets chilly on the course. We saw every season it seemed like that out there weather-wise. What is golf truly like in Ireland in terms of the elements and how it can change so quickly?
That's what it's like right there. I mean, you're usually going to get two, perhaps three seasons in every round of golf you play, and it may not actually be any of the seasons you're actually in on the calendar. What is it about Shane Lowry and lousy weather? I mean, when he won the Irish Open as an amateur back in 2009 at Baltrae, about an hour north of Dublin, it was torrential rain. You know, an arc passed him in the fairway on one of those rounds. And then he goes to Royal Portrush for the Open Championship a decade after that, in 2019. And that was a rough weather week. There was a lot of rain, there was a lot of wind. He was in full rain gear when he won that championship on Sunday in very, very tough, demanding conditions. There's just something that brings out a grittiness in him. And it's not a surprise to see Lowry or Padraig Harrington survive and even thrive in weather conditions like this. I mean, you remember that Open that Harrington won at Birkdale. The wind almost blew every tent off the property that week as well. But there's a little... That's where you show the grittiness that comes out in a lot of players. And that's the kind of thing we might see in St. Andrews in a couple of weeks, because the weather is very, very fickle in St. Andrews as well. And the wind has been a factor. The last two Opens there in 2010 and 2015, we've seen suspensions of play because of the wind. So that kind of grittiness, the attitude, the stoicism when you're faced with really lousy weather, that to me is a test that they're going to face in 2 weeks. So even though this is not on a Lynx golf course for the Irish Open this week with Mount Juliet Estate, the conditions and the test of attitude might be worth something 2 weeks down the road.
Yeah, patience will be tested over the course of the next couple of days. We'll see how that plays out. And as Jorge Campillo says, maybe not comfortable in a birdie fest, but if he's got to make birdies, that's what he's going to do. Coming up next, a Golf Today staple, the past champion chat, where Kurt Byram will join us to talk John Deere Classic, the PGA Tour event he won way back when. Stay with us. Byram on tap.
Let's take it back to 1989 when Kurt Byram captured his solo PGA Tour victory at the John Deere Classic. It was a different sponsor back then and a different venue in the Quad Cities, but the win meant just as much to Kurt as it will to someone else on Sunday.
I had done my work and I kind of deserved it. I didn't, not to be cocky, but I just felt like it was my time finally. I had worked hard on my game this year and the last couple years, and finally it all paid off. And I just couldn't have been happier.
As we've noted all week long, the John Deere Classic is a great tradition of giving players their first wins on the PGA Tour and kickstarting some great careers in the process. There's the guys who came after Kurt Byram: Jordan Spieth, Brian Harman, Bryson DeChambeau, Michael Kim, and most recently, in 2019, Dylan Fratelli. And for this week's edition of the Past Champions Chat, we say hello to Kurt Byram. Kurt, you're on the call this week. Do you still get the good vibes every time you go back to the Quad Cities?
Actually, I do. I have a lot of good friends here in the Quad Cities through all those years of playing here, and it's really fun. It's, you know, I grew up in the Midwest in South Dakota, so it kind of reminds me of all the farm fields around this area. It's pretty cool for me. I love coming back here.
Kurt, when you look back to 1989 and that victory, what stands out in terms of a particular shot around a moment where you truly realized this was your breakthrough week?
Well, I really, you know, it came down to the last hole. I really had a lot of pressure. The last hole at Oakwood is a really tight hole with a penalty area left and OB right. And back in those days, I carried a one iron. And so that was the club I'd been hitting off the tee all week. And I knew I just had to put that that last tee shot in the fairway. And it was pretty much over if I could just, you know, get to the top of the hill and put it on the green from there. So it was really that last tee shot, and I was able to, there's one overhanging tree I remember there on 18. I was able to get it past that tree. I hit it solid and hit it right up the middle of the fairway, and it was a pretty good feeling walking out to that tee shot that day. But it was just all good memories there. I had a good week with the putter, which was always the problem for me. I was not a good putter, and for some reason that week, the greens were quick, and I just felt like I was dialed in on my speed, and finally, you know, the ball striking was there, and typically week in and week out it was pretty good. And finally my putter showed up for me that week, and I was able to pick off the win.
Did your attitude change after that win, Kurt, going forward? Did you feel more pressure or expectation now that you were a PGA Tour winner, that you somehow had to deliver more than you would otherwise?
Yeah, that's interesting, Eamon. You know, part of it was I felt a little bit of pressure off because my brother Tom had won maybe a month before I won at the old Kemper Open in Washington, D.C. So, you know, I was the older brother. I'd been out here longer, and I still had yet to win. So I was feeling some pressure just from the family side of that. But the other part of that was when I did finally win, it sort of validated in my head that I was good enough to be out here, even though I had been out for a few years already. But it definitely, I think it changes you a little bit as far as, you know, the category you put yourself in as a tournament winner. So I would say it took more pressure off at that time. And it felt like, you know, at the time, it felt like the future was pretty bright.
When you take a look at some of the first-time winners here, your name was on that list, Jordan Spieth, Bryson DeChambeau, among others. Why do you think this event in particular seems to be a springboard for a lot of these up-and-comers to have that breakthrough moment?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think part of it is, you know, some of the younger guys, especially like Spieth and DeChambeau, when they got here, you know, they had a lot of confidence already, and maybe the strength of field, you know, when they looked at that, they said, okay, well, this is going to be a really good opportunity. First of all, I'm playing really well coming in, and with the strength of field, I should have a chance if I play my game. And I think that's part of it. But also, you know, a lot of these guys, I mean, they just all of a sudden they build up to it, the couple top tens, whatever, and then all of a sudden they show up here and they're on form and they pick off that first win of their career. So I'm not sure, other than that, I'm not sure why it's here.
Kurt, you're still out there on tour a lot, and there's obviously a lot of turmoil going on in the game these days. Do you sense any kind of change in the mood or attitude among the guys out there in the locker room towards their peers who've gone to play the LIV Golf Series?
I have not sensed any change from player to player among the guys that are still playing here versus the guys that have gone to play the LIV. It's obviously a topic of conversation every week, not just among, you know, the guys doing the TV work that week. It's the players are talking about it. I mean, if you walk to the range, inevitably somebody brings it up and it gets discussed. So it's definitely the topic of conversation out here on the PGA Tour right now. But I have not sensed anything, any animosity between the players.
As we get ready for second round coverage at 3 p.m. Eastern, Kurt, and we take a look at the leaderboard. Matthias Schwab is up there looking to win for the first time. Standout at Vanderbilt, Chris Goddard. The sponsor's exemption, we've seen what he's done at Oklahoma as he just joined the professional ranks. Why do you believe these young 20-somethings join professional golf and get these PGA Tour starts perhaps more ready than someone like you, you know, 30-plus years ago?
Well, I think college golf itself has changed tremendously over the last probably 10, 12 years. And I think Golf Channel has a lot to do with that. The fact that we televise a number of college events, but we started with the NCAA championship. And I think the fact that these guys are more used to having the cameras behind them while they're out there trying to win a national title, I think that really sets them up to be over that hump when they get out here. The TV part of it doesn't bother them at all by the time they get to the PGA Tour. You know, and I think you look at the Korn Ferry Tour, it's always been the spot that is just producing some great players year in and year out. So I think the fact that they're under pressure to win and get to the PGA Tour, so that sort of just totally gets them ready for the competition once they get out here. Not everybody, but a lot of these guys are very ready once they get to the PGA Tour. And there's no fear, there's no intimidation for most of these guys. And once they tee it up out here, they expect to continue to play well, just like they did in college or just like they did on the Korn Ferry Tour.
Kurt, always good to catch up. All the best on the broadcast. And enjoy the trip down memory lane this week in the Quad Cities for you.
Yeah, we're having a good week. Thank you.
You got it, Kurt Byron. He'll be part of our broadcast coming your way at 3 p.m. Eastern. And after the break, that's our good friend Billy Kratzer. He joins us next in studio, and he might have a little tip for you that could help lower your score during your next round on the links. Stay tuned. Billy Kratzer on deck on Golf Today. Second round highlights from the John Deere Classic. Take a look at Christian Bezuidenhout. This for birdie at the third, 23 feet or so. He gets it to go. He moves to 8 under par. How about Charles Howell the third at the par 4 6? Just short of the green. See what he can do. Try to stay at 8 under. Takes the high route. Lands softly. Able to save his par and remain at 8 under par for Charles Howell III as we take a look at the leaderboard. Again, there was a weather delay of about an hour and 15 minutes. Not a ton of rain came through. They're back out there, and Matthias Schwab has joined JT Poston, 9 under par. I keep looking at Chris Goddard up that sponsor's exemption. One of those at 8 under and just a shot back. And with that, we say hello to our friend Billy Kratzer, 4-time PGA Tour winner out there, Billy. And when you take a look at the leaderboard and some of the highlights we have seen, what's the knee-jerk reaction to day two at the John Deere?
Well, I think the fact that the guys are out on the golf course and they're playing a golf course where the presentation has remained the same. We've had the little weather, but all in all, the golf course is playing very much like it did yesterday. Guys are getting out there early, posting a good score, and we've had guys, we saw a lot of great shots. So we're seeing great shots again today. But what I'm going to address is the shots we saw yesterday. And we saw some pretty good bunker shots from not only our leader, but from Morgan Hoffman.
Yeah, we're going to do a little bit of a pivot here. You're a man that's played on the tour for a couple of decades and have a lot of knowledge in the golf swing. That can maybe help some of our viewers. That was Poston holing out from the bunker there at the fourth yesterday.
Yeah, and what you notice, the hands were carried very low. You look at Morgan Hoffman right here. Look how low the hands are. Being able to produce the speed from there, that's critical. And that's why they're successful hitting bunker shots. And what I see, Berko, a lot of times is the amateurs, what they'll do is they'll go in there with, okay, their driver setup or their 5-iron setup, and they end up with their hands being high, pretty much the arms extended, and everything set up to hit a shot, a full shot, either a sweeping driver or a 5-iron like that. But when you look at the technique and you look at the mechanics of the guys on tour or any professional golf tour, you know, you'll see the adjustment. And they kind of preset everything, and it's so important because that's what makes them a successful bunker player. It makes it easier for them. And that's what you want to do as an amateur. Okay, I don't want to fear the bunker. I want to get in there. All the pros, they want to be in a bunker, but amateurs don't. But what you can do at home is you can actually put a little more flex in your legs right here. What that's going to enable you to do is then you're going to have a look to where your hands are being carried just a little bit lower. You don't want them up here. That's going to promote a dig. Down here, you can use the sole of the club, and then you can go ahead and let it glance off the sand. You want to try to hit a couple inches behind it. But everything is preset, Berko. And if you preset it from here, what you want to do is create the angle. Then the key component in making this shot a good one is to make sure that you keep the speed up. You'll notice that these guys, when they go through the shot, everything is speed and then the chest towards the target. Speed towards the target. That's how you elevate it. That's how you put spin on it. And hopefully our guy over there, Eamon, is listening.
Yeah, he might need a little more than a free lesson with Billy Cratchard. He might need a series of three for $100 an hour. But something to think about, Billy Cratchard, four-time winner on the PGA Tour. A little advice the next time you are in the bunker. JT posting that 9-under-62 on day number one. He's warming up on the putting green at TPC Deer Run. Again, his tee time about an hour away with the delay. And how about Matthias Schwab closes with birdie. He shoots 65. In the clubhouse at 10 under par. Poston, as he said, by the time he tees it up for his second round, he might not be leading. His words came true. Still to come on the second hour of Golf Today, we check back in on the John Deere Classic, see if the Zadenhout and others can make a run. The rain has come and gone. Kira K. Dixon, Kurt Byram telling us we should be in the clear. Very little wind, high temperatures. And about the 70s, maybe low 80s in the Quad Cities. And we will keep you updated as hour number two of Golf Today coming around the corner.
Golf Today. Brought to you by PointsBet.
Greetings and welcome on this Friday edition of Golf Today. Hour number two off and running. Steve Burkowski alongside Eamon Lynch. And I say, well, let's get right to it. Second round highlights of the John Deere Classic from TPC Deer Run, where everyone was trying to surpass what JT Poston did on Thursday, 9-under-62. Plenty made a great case, like David Lipsky here at 14. This for birdie.
From 28 feet, gets it to 5-under, a little bit closer to Poston.
Yeah, then the par 5 second, his second from 222. Quality long iron for the man who played his college golf at Northwestern.
He would end up two-putting that for birdie. Got him to 8-under.
Squarely in the mix is Lipsky in search of his first career PGA Tour victory. So too is Michael Gligic at the par 3 16th. I think one of the underappreciated par 3s, especially on this golf course, water to the left, just seemingly, in my opinion, goes under the radar. And some of the fireworks do happen there. That one would spin back to 5 feet, gets him to 8-under par. How about Charles Howell III? At 16, if he can roll it, got to watch out for him.
One of the wiliest veterans out here on the tour. This from 17 feet, gets to 5-under.
Charles Howell III has been at this for 21-plus years, and he's there each and every year. How about this long fairway bunker shot at the first?
From 107 yards, we'll spin this down to 4 feet. He would also make that. Time to 6-under.
And maybe not that long, but it was 107 yards. You get my point. And at the par 5 second, saw the clouds lingering in there. There would be a weather delay shortly after for about an hour and 15 minutes. But before the horn sounded, Charles hit a quality one here. He would 2-putt for birdie, move him to 8-under par. Christian Bezuidenhout, the par 3 third, 23-footer for birdie.
Closing in on the lead here. Drops that, gets to 8-under.
Making it look easy, but I'm somewhat surprised that no one has gotten to 10, 11, 12 under par, you know, a little bit deeper considering the conditions. But Matthias Schwab did birdie his last to shoot 65, former Vanderbilt All-America selection, 10 under. Got a one-shot lead over Bezuidenhout. Again, JT Poston hasn't even teed off. He'll get going about 45 minutes from now. But after Matthias Schwab shot that Friday 65, he caught up with Kira K. Dixon.
All right, nice birdie putt there on the last to get you to 10 under for the tournament. Matthias, just take us through round two and what you were able to do so well to get you to that number.
Yeah, I actually got off to a nice start on the first hole and made birdie there, but then kind of got stuck on the front nine. But then I lit it up on the back nine. I shot 6-under on the last nine. I don't know. I mean, things just started to click. Made some nice putts on the last few holes. It was a nice day.
Where were you when the horn blew, and how did that affect your momentum, if at all?
I was lucky enough. I hit the drive on 14 on the green, so I had a nice eagle putt from 50 feet, and I lagged it up to 3 feet, and then they blew the horn. So, so I had almost a tap in for birdie to start the round again.
What do you think the conditions will look like for the players teeing it up in the afternoon?
Well, I haven't checked the forecast, but I mean, it was very calm when we got back out. The greens were nice and soft, rolling nicely. I think scoring will be pretty low in the afternoon.
Well, good luck over the weekend.
Thank you.
The mild-mannered, soft-spoken Matthias Schwab in position 10 under par. What's your takeaways from what we've seen from this morning wave that's now crept into the afternoon?
Well, Matthias Schwab is evidence of just how fickle golf is, because if you look at individual stroke play events on the PGA Tour, take out the Zurich Classic of New Orleans, the team event, he hasn't finished in the top 50 in a PGA Tour event since the Valero Texas Open. He tied eighth there. That was 3 months ago. Here he is, suddenly finding his game out of nowhere. And to me, that's just kind of both the mystery and the majesty of this game out there, right? You see guys who are suddenly appearing from the absolute depths. JT Poston is the same. He missed the last two cuts in the playoff events at the end of last season. He missed the first six cuts of this season. So there was eight missed cuts in a row for JT Poston. He's since suddenly found a little bit more of a consistent vein in his game out there. Still misses the occasional cut. He's a lot of feast and famine in his game, but he's found several top tens in there as well. Obviously played really well at Travelers last week as well. You just never know when it's going to be your week out there.
Yeah, let me give you a little known fact about Matthias Schwab. When I first met him years ago in college in amateur golf, said, tell me something we don't know about you. And growing up in Austria, when he was about 8 or 9 years old, he appeared on a David Letterman type variety show juggling on a unicycle, especially during the pandemic. If you followed Matthias Schwab on social media, he'd be the guy climbing up mountains in Europe, juggling a golf ball every step of the way. How does that impact what he does this next two rounds? Probably absolutely no bearing whatsoever, but it's an indication of, as you said, the fine line of talent and really a comfort level, whether it's Poston, whether it's Matthias Schwab, of they know they're good enough, they know they can play. Why do you think it takes maybe some of these guys longer than those true special players that make the transition so easy?
You know, everyone kind of matures at their own rate, and it seems to be the situation in golf over probably since the Tiger era, I would argue, where this perception has been skewed as to when a golfer is supposed to find that kind of sweet spot in terms of their career. If you go back to the 80s, 70s, the 90s even, mid-30s was considered when a golfer was rising into his prime. Now, if you're not in your prime by your mid to late 20s, you start getting written off to some degree. And some of these guys, you look at Lipsky's now, he's 33 years old. He earned his status this year through what he did in the Korn Ferry Tour last year. He has experience. He just doesn't necessarily have enough experience being in the crunch moments. And, you know, Kurt Byron made an interesting point earlier how college golf has accelerated that process for a lot of these guys. But that all started to happen, I think, after guys like David Lipsky were out of the college system. So they're kind of finding their own way in the world. And frankly, some guys just simply peak at that level of being an acceptable tour player. They're not necessarily the type who are going to win out here, but can make a very nice living out in professional golf as well on either side of the Atlantic. And that's the reality for some guys. But all of them this week, certainly the guys we just looked at today, they all think they can win. And more to that, there's that little added bit of pressure because very few of those guys are already exempt into the Open Championship. And three of those spots from the top 10 are up for grabs by Sunday night.
Yeah, that's the tournament within the tournament the next couple of days. As a youngster, did you ever appear on TV juggling on a unicycle?
I can say with some certainty that never happened.
That makes two of us. I'm not really sure why I threw that Matthias Schwab note out there, but some good fodder for those to talk about Matthias Schwab. And we take a look at his scorecard. Really an indifferent start, 35 even par on the front nine, but look at that finish. Six birdies, 30 coming home, including birdies at 16, 17, and 18, all part of a round of six under 65 for Matthias Schwab. Remember, second round coverage of the John Deere Classic immediately follows Golf Today. That begins at 3 p.m. Eastern right here on Golf Channel. The tournament competition, not the only thing competing for fan interest this weekend at the John Deere Classic. Amidst all the coolest tractors imaginable, how about taking a couple of swings with the world's largest putter attached to a John Deere excavator? It weighs just a mere 330 pounds, is 5 feet long, and has a 13-inch face. And Austin Cook from the PGA Tour took a couple of swipes at it earlier this week.
I think that's the ticket right there to get the break in there. All right, here goes attempt number one. Go, 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 go! First try, baby. Arkansas boy, feeling right at home on a John Deere. Boy, you gotta have perfect touch on this one to get the full turn in it. Go. Go. Keep going. Two for two. Let's go. This is what I need on the course. This is too easy.
A perfect slate for Austin. He made his third try as well. Fans on site will have the opportunity to test their luck with the putter all weekend long. And Eamon, I think Austin Cook has found a way to ensure that both of us can make a few more putts.
Well, some of the game's most promising up-and-comers are battling each other in the Swiss Alps this week, the Arnold Palmer Cup. We'll discuss some of the talent on both teams right after the break.
We're back on Golf Today, and sure, the Horizon Irish Open is going on, and the event has shown what most of us already know. Golf in Ireland is special, but golf in Ireland is more than just a game. Now is your time to write your next storied adventure in Ireland. And speaking of the Irish Open, how about we take a look at some second round highlights from earlier today? A lot of people out watching Padraig Harrington put on a bit of a show here. His third from just off the green at 17, the par 5. He would hit it to a foot. He would make birdie. Shoot 71 in at 3 under par. Shane Lowry had some work to do coming down the stretch if he was going to be around for the weekend. This was for birdie at 12.
From 19 feet, made it, got back to even, but he was still two outside the cut line at that stage.
Yeah, had to keep it rolling along. Could he do it with this 12.5 footer at 16? Sir Good makes it, gets to 1 under par. Another one at 18 would certainly help with all the fans surrounding that green.
A nice exclamation point on Shane's day. Finish it with 4 birdies in a row. Shoot 70.
How about that finish by Shane Lowry? Should assure him a tee time bright and early Saturday morning. Seamus Power, another Irishman here at the par 5 fifth. This for birdie.
25 feet. And he's the leading home country contender.
That would move him to 4 under par. Then at the par 4 seventh, another birdie putt.
And another one goes down, 5 under par.
Power showing a bit of touch on the greens. Here at the par 3 11th. A trend, a lot of 15, 20 footers and a lot that are going in. Seamus Power makes it, shoots his second straight round of 4 under 68, 8 under par through 36 holes, but others playing pretty well as well, like Adrian Marunk, this for birdie at the first.
From 13 feet to get to 9 under.
Good scoring conditions in Ireland, a little bit of rain today. How about Marunk, his second at 9?
From 117 yards, nestles that into 1 foot 8 inches.
Yeah, hit it about 118 and change. He makes birdie, second straight 67. He's in at 10 under par. They're all trying to catch Jorge Campillo, his second at the par 5 fifth, from 237 yards out.
This is why he's leading to 4 feet 6 inches.
But he would miss it for eagle. 2-putt for birdie, shoots 68 in at 11 under par. Campillo, the man they're all trying to catch come Saturday at the Irish Open. But there's a lot of local flavor there as well who are excited about the next 2 days ahead.
That was pretty cool. Look, to be honest, I had kind of almost half resigned myself to the fact that I was going home packing my bags. Don't know if I've ever birdied the last 4 to make a cut, so that's a first. And yeah, I'm just happy to be in the weekend. I know, you know, everybody knows how much this tournament means to me and how much I want to be here. And I know that it's sold out at the weekend, and I know there's quite a few people that want to come down and see me play. So you know, it's nice that I'm here now, and I'm looking forward to it again.
It was an exciting thing to watch as well. Seamus, 8 under for the tournament, 3 back behind the leader. Can you just describe to us the atmosphere? I don't think I've ever seen anything like it.
Yeah, it was definitely a first for me. That was it was a lot of fun coming down near the end there, and obviously Shane holding that putt on the last. I mean, that was a loud roar as you hear on the course, you know, especially on a Friday. So yeah, it was nice to be a part of it. I was delighted I was able to make a putt after, because it took extra couple of seconds. But yeah, it's great. You know, it's great to be in for the weekend, and hopefully, he said sold out crowd, so should be a more good atmosphere, I'd say.
It's a beautiful thing in this sport, isn't it? Your competitors standing next to each other, couldn't be happier for each other. Overall, going into
the
weekend,
I'm disappointed. He's 5 ahead.
Well, Shane, going into the weekend, you know, what's the tactics? What can you see happening?
Yeah, I need to go low tomorrow, obviously, but I feel like I found something today, definitely on the back nine, so I'm excited for the weekend and the Pro-Am Monday, Tuesday, and the Open. So I honestly was telling myself, I think that's why I allowed myself to play good golf, because I was telling myself coming down the last few holes that I actually felt like I found something on the greens, and I felt like I found something mentally. So, I'm looking forward to the weekend.
And Seamus, what about for you?
Yeah, for me, I'm just going to be, you know, try to do more of the same. I actually was very pleased on the back nine there as well. Hit some better shots than I've been hitting, and I like the greens. Putter's been rolling pretty well, so hopefully more of the same on the weekend.
Well, great stuff, guys. Enjoy.
Yeah, I do.
It.
Thanks.
Thank you.
In less than 2 weeks, the world's top players will descend on the home of golf for the 150th Open Championship at St Andrews. It will be the 30th time the old course has played host to the game's oldest major. To celebrate the Open's 150th anniversary, Golf Channel's newest film, The Open at St Andrews, dives into the long history of iconic moments at the old course through the stories of the greats, Palmer, Nicklaus, Ballesteros, Woods, and many others. You won't want to miss this.
My first Open that I came to watch here was 1984. I had followed Tom on Saturday around this course in a windy day. Wonderful to watch him moving the golf ball around the golf course.
And most people felt that Tom was going to win, but then Seve came with a charge.
As for Ballesteros, he was tied for fifth after the first round, and then climbed the leaderboard the next day, shooting a 68.
Well, now, Seve, we saw him play pretty well yesterday.
But in the third round, Watson overtook him, shooting a 66, tied for the best score of the championship.
And how quickly the fortunes of golf can change.
Leaving Ballesteros 2 shots back heading into the tournament's final day.
It appeared that one of those two was probably going to win. Being an American, obviously, I was somewhat pulling for Tom Watson.
Playing one group apart and staying within a stroke of one another for most of the day, it looked like they were headed for a tie. Then came the 17th hole, the road hole. Notorious for making or breaking players in the biggest moments.
When I was on the tee, I say to myself, you know, anything except going to the right. I hit the left.
I can still see him hitting a 6-iron at 17 out of the wispy rough. Ground has exploded as the ball's moved around.
That's a marvellous shot. What a great shot under these circumstances.
The odds are slightly in Seve's favour at this moment.
It was the first time all week Ballesteros had parred the 17th.
A par 4, and Ballesteros stays 11.
Next, all eyes turned to Watson.
Back on the 17th tee.
I'm tied, and I know what I have to do. I hit a shot from the upslope there. Blocked it out to the right.
Oh. Oh, dear, oh, dear, oh, dear.
Over the green, against the wall, on the other side of the road, you've got no chance.
And he'll have to hold that putt if he's to stay tied for the lead with Ballesteros.
I know I have to make the putt for par. And it wasn't to be.
Watson's bogey put him 1 stroke behind Ballesteros, who by now was on the final green, squaring up a 12-foot putt for birdie to assure the win.
And that putt at the last, I mean, I don't know how many times I've seen it, But, you know, I've got it now. You know, I get a tear in the eye just remembering that ball sitting on the edge of the hole. And I believe he willed the ball into the hole. Pure will.
I thought the ball was going to stay on the lip. Perhaps it was the willpower.
And then he started his celebration. And it went on and on and on. Then he just stands up and he starts punching the eyes. And the roar went on and on and on.
That was the greatest moment of my career.
The Open at St. Andrews will premiere July 6th at 8 p.m. Eastern. So, Steve, that 18th hole at the Old Course gets my vote as the single greatest stage in the single greatest sport. Had so many iconic moments. Almost every great actor in the history of the game has played there, with the sole exception, actually, of Ben Hogan. What's your favourite memory from that hole?
Goosebumps watching that. Anything as you documented on that final hole. I go back to 1995, Costantino Rocca, short hair, his second from the Valley of Sin, and you sit there in disbelief that he did that, knowing he's got to make three somehow, some way, to get a little bonus golf with John Daly. This has got no chance of going in.
It was motoring.
Until it does. Drops to his knees, hits the ground, pounding the ground there at St. Andrews. I mean, we talked about Jack yesterday in 05, Rocca in 95. As you said, every actor had their moment, had their few lines to write, and that's just another one that jumped to the forefront for me.
And he had a great moment, and then, of course, had the negative aspect of that where he didn't actually win the playoff. And I think of another guy who had a wonderful run at St. Andrews, but it ended with tragedy, if you want to use that word, on the 18th hole of the Old Course, which was Doug Sanders back in the Open in 1970, where he had this putt to win the Open Championship. He missed it. He almost got to the hole before the ball did. Went on the next day to lose a playoff to Jack Nicklaus. And you kind of wonder the impact that putt had on Doug's career after that. He was quoted a few years ago when the Open was back in St. Andrews in 2015 saying that sometimes a whole hour would go by without him thinking about that shot. And, you know, he was 37 years old when he hit that putt. He'd won 18 times on the PGA Tour. He only won twice after that. He'd been a runner-up. That was his fourth runner-up in major championships, with a couple of thirds as well. He never again contended in a major championship, but he came back to St. Andrews as often as he could. He came back during every Open because that was the town where Doug Sanders was still relevant in this game, even if it wasn't necessarily for a great reason.
He stood over that putt forever. Trevino's reaction, disbelief, just one of the many storylines written at St. Andrews. See what will happen in a couple weeks from now. Remember, second round coverage of the John Deere Classic immediately following us on Golf Today. We're 6 minutes and change from round two coverage. Stay right here, Golf Today. Going to wrap it up when we come back.
Golf Today, brought to you by PointsBet. This season, don't just bet, live your bet life.
We know Tiger Woods is the biggest draw in the game, and the next time he'll tee it up for the public will be on Monday at the J.P. McManus Pro-Am. It will be the first time we see Tiger since the PGA Championship at Southern Hills. You can catch all the action on Peacock, 9 a.m. Eastern. That comes your way on Monday. Eamon, been a fun couple of days with you alongside here, this Golf Today desk. Hope I did you proud.
You always do, Steve. It's going to be an interesting weekend of golf. Let the lawyers go to work now and sort out the rest of it, and we'll circle back next week.
Yeah, I don't know if they work on the weekends. We might have to wait. Second round coverage of the John Deere Classic coming your way next. Enjoy the golf.